So I represented a lot of people in this same position, everything from dentists to pediatricians, other physician groups, consulting companies, other law firms, and this is the best way to do it.
Hey, pronouncers, welcome back. This is the legal episode. We're getting into the weeds, a little bit of tax, but more so on legal entities, setting up your business correctly, not just when you're starting your shop, but also if you're a little bit down the road and you want to get things cleaned up. If you've got partners and don't have what's called an operating agreement, here's why you really, really should have one. And then lastly, real estate. Steven sharing his real estate secrets. He's a real estate mogul. No, but we're getting into how to set that up.
Our attorney, one of our attorneys, James Bowie, has been a friend, a longtime friend, and decided to come on and give some of his advice. Just a lot of really great nuggets. And it's a fun episode. I know talking about law and tax is boring, but super relevant, especially this time of the year. But this podcast would not be possible without our incredible sponsors. Bruce, kick us off.
If you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, GraphX offers industry-leading options for your shop by truly becoming a part of your team. They plug and play with Printavo, a bunch of other shop management solutions, though, too. They do SEPs, mock-up, creative art, digitizing, all that good stuff, and just really seamlessly work with your team. So that's super helpful. Hit them up, graphxsource.com. You can mention Printavo Pod 24. That'll get 50% off your first order to give it a test. Thanks, GraphX.
Bruce, have you heard of Multicraft underscore daddy? He is most recently the next best thing on Instagram. But if you need ink supplies or a daddy, Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies for over 50 years have been providing you with top brands at competitive prices. You can mention the Printavo podcast. You're going to get 10% off your first order. And Dave gives away free PMI tape per episode. So if you DM him, he'll enter you into a raffle. Actually, he did his last raffle drawing. He put all the names in and then he couldn't read them, put his cheaters on or something like that. And the videos he's made the last couple of weeks have been amazing. He's in the country. He's wearing flannel. He's throwing axes. Daddy's ready. So, yeah. Thanks, Multicraft. We appreciate you.
DGI Apparel. If you go to dgiapparel.com, this is a really cool website. It just helps purchasing be so seamless and easy. Not only that, they've got a beta program with Printavo to help make purchasing really, really quick. I've seen the video demo. It's incredible. You can get on that in that Printavo unofficial Facebook group. But I mean, just you could save so much time with purchasing because of how they set it up. They plug and play with all of your distributors. You can see prices, inventory, ship times, all that good stuff. And it is free to use. So dgiapparel.com.
Bruce, I know back in the day you were spending hours cleaning dirty screens. That's a thing of the past. You actually sent me some pictures of the shirts you were hustling outside of the stadium at U of I. And I bet you were spending a ton of time cleaning dirty screens. But that's a thing of the past with EasyWay screen printing and screen cleaning chemicals. Their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively so you can spend less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, EasyWay is passionate about empowering printers of all skill levels. They offer helpful resources, expert advice to help you succeed in printing. There's no other company like EasyWay. We use them at Campus Inc. Thanks so much, EasyWay. We appreciate you.
I did not know about dip tanks then. But you know what's really cool? I do see so many new shops getting started at trade shows. And I feel like it was a good 6-8 years before I went to the first trade show. It would have saved a lot of time. All right, guys, let's jump into the episode. Mr. James Babawi of Babawi Law. This is kind of an interesting connection. James, you were helping give us some advice as we were getting fabric started, which we kicked off and are actually sending emails out today for kicking off first three groups. So that's incredible. So obviously, thank you, James, to helping us figure that out. James, you've got an incredible background. I was reading through your bio, just having, you know, gone back to school to get your MBA, gone back to school to get your law degree and pass the bar. Which you do with your wife, it sounded like, at the same time. So that's kind of cool. And then, you know, you've done interning with a federal judge. You've worked with a lot of small businesses, obviously. You've done humanitarian work. You've done all this really cool stuff, which, I mean, gosh, Stephen, could you go back to school? Like, I don't think I could ever be put in that environment again.
No. So here's the funny story. James and I grew up together. Well, you probably carried me as a baby. I don't, maybe, I think so.
No, yeah. You were a little older than that.
I was a little older than that.
But you were always like a younger kid that I knew was going places.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're Egyptian, you're either a doctor, a lawyer, or engineer. And so, you know, all my siblings are either doctors, lawyers, and I came out a t-shirt printer. So I am the black sheep of the community, if you will. But what's really cool is, James, we've known each other obviously our entire lives, but as I've worked at Campus Inc. and done like some stuff on the side, you've always just been our attorney for just the most random of different things, different filings, different agreements. And I think what's really interesting is, especially in this day and age, a lot of these shop owners are really starting to professionalize, think about exit strategies, restructuring. And we're starting to get a lot of questions that are almost like, phew, I have no idea how that works. So we figured it'd be cool to bring you on. We've had some CFOs on here, CPAs on here, but just to have some open dialogue about the boring shit you call law that you enjoy. So I don't know, Bruce, where do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, I think it's exciting because I don't think anyone starts a business and is like, how should I best set this company up, right? Like how, you know, should it be this corp, that corp? Does it matter? Do I just start doing things and we'll figure it out later? And so I think there's a couple different sections here. So the first one is starting the business basics and like legally getting a company. And I don't even think this needs to be starting, but it could be, you know, you're a little bit further down and you want to get things professionally organized. And then I also want to talk about real estate stuff. And then lastly, get into like, if you're selling the business. I mean, we were talking to a shop the other day. They're like, yeah, I think it's a good time, to do something else. How to legally start to think about that and structure it. I've seen things go well, and I've also seen things go very bad. And so how can owners help protect themselves? So let's just kick it off first. Setting up a business. I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is what type of entity should it be, right? There's S-Corp, LLC, there's C-Corp, then there's sole prop, and then sole prop can be a part of those. And then like, and then if there's partners, anyway, what do you think? Like, what is the de facto go-to for the entity type of business that we should be looking at?
That's a great question. First and foremost, I just want to thank you guys for inviting me onto this podcast. Super exciting. And it's always been a pleasure to help you guys out with whatever needs you've had. And that being said, I think that the way we're structuring this is really good in just terms of like these kind of three buckets. And I think it does make sense to sort of start out with the creation of the company and choosing what sort of business entity someone wants to move forward with. You phrased the question in a really, really good way. Like, what is the de facto? And what we see most generally is that companies start out as an LLC, which is a limited liability company. And there's a couple of reasons why. LLCs are, first and foremost, the easiest to set up. It used to be in the state of Illinois that the annual renewal fee was pretty expensive, like $250. But a few years ago, the state of Illinois, I know that this podcast is not exclusive to Illinois, but that's where I'm licensed. But they've reduced those annual fees. And a lot of states have actually followed suit and done that. So just from a monetary point of view, sometimes it just makes most sense to do an LLC. Obviously, as the business entity's title entails, one of the benefits and the main benefit to most business owners of the LLC is that limitation of liability. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that. There's sort of like, maybe it's a misinterpretation by some, maybe it's not, but there's this thinking that if you're the member of the LLC, which is the owner of the LLC, that you have some ultimate protection from liability personally, which is generally the default rule. But there are some caveats to that. Like if an LLC member is, for example, operating outside the scope of what would normally be considered a business activity in their industry, if they have committed fraud, sometimes in some states, even the commingling of personal and business funds could allow potential creditors to do what's called piercing the corporate veil, which is sort of a term of art.
What does it mean, meddling between? Because when I think about it, right, it's like, well, I'm putting on my money into it. And sure, some of the finances are probably going to be mixed when we're getting started.
Like Bruce, like let's just say you buy a new printing press. That's $150,000 press, right? And your company has no credit. It's probably going to flow back to yourself, you.
Or yeah, a car. Right? Or...
Yeah, right. Is that what you mean? Keep going.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, so the interesting thing about an LLC, which is kind of ironic in reference to this conversation of commingling funds, is that it's actually what they call a pass-through tax entity, which means that all the profits and expenses associated with the LLC at the end of the year just trickle down to the owner's personal 1040, which is the tax return that we all fill out. Whereas we'll talk about this a little bit later, but for a corporation, it's a totally different tax form. You fill out an 1120, which is just a little bit different. It sort of, you know, creates a fiscal or monetary separation between the owner and the entity. But to go back to your question, about the commingling of funds, what they're really looking for is not how you finance something necessarily, but maybe more so how you take profits. And the way that you take those profits, if you are, for example, writing off business expenses through the LLC that are really not business expenses, you know, you're taking your girlfriend out to dinner and you say, hey, this could look like a good expense on my tax return. And, you know, you charge that like wrongful expenses. That would be an example of the commingling of financial resources that could lead to the piercing of the corporate veil. And what that means if the corporate veil is pierced is that you don't have that limitation of liability that the LLC affords you. And instead, you could become essentially personally liable for those claims of creditors. So that's one thing. And one thing I want to say about that is even state to state, there's been a lot of precedent set in different courts of different competent jurisdictions that have ruled on very similar sets of facts in different ways. So this is also extremely localized, which is important to realize. A lot of people think that if something is either illegal or legal or permissible or not permissible, or that they're liable or not liable. And what we learn very quickly as attorneys, and you guys as sophisticated business people have probably figured this out too, is that there's a lot of gray area, right? There's a lot of area where one court may rule a certain way, another court may rule a different way on very similar or identical facts. That being said, I mean, go ahead.
If a debtor wanted to come after, like, there's a lot of financing that's happening, right? But what do you mean by protection? As in, you know, let's say you have a loan out, you're for whatever reason not able to make payments on it. Is there a certain max amount that they can go after? Can they go after a personal asset, or that's what you mean by piercing the veil? Or like what's the limit? Where's the protection? Oh,
in practice, the question that we're asking is sort of mostly academic and not that practical, because of the fact that usually, and you guys probably have experience with this too, for things like a lease or financing of things that you're going to use in your business, for LLCs that are not super established, a creditor is going to require a personal guarantee anyway. So we see that that's sort of like the workaround to their need to pierce a corporate veil. There's really no corporate veil to pierce if, for example, you sign a lease for your office and you sign it individually with your name.
You're on it anyway.
You're on it anyway.
What is the protection from then generally that you see?
So some LLCs and some corporations are able to obtain credit in the name of the business once they've established enough long-term success, and banks will basically, and financial institutions would lend to them. In that case, the LLC would basically collateralize their own assets and maybe things that they own against the note or the amount that they're borrowing, so that the LLC would be the only thing that's liable. And that usually happens when a financial institution can basically ensure that they're going to get paid because the LLC has enough cash or assets to be credit worthy enough to extend them a loan. So basically in that case, you know, the legal fiction of the LLC being like treated like an individual or a human kind of kicks in. We know an LLC, a corporation, is not a human. Obviously, it's made up of groups of humans usually, or a single member human. But that being said, if the LLC gets its own credit rating and is able to borrow money in its individual capacity as a company, then that's where the corporate veil really comes in for things like financial transactions. So the corporate veil has other applications other than just borrowing money or signing a lease, like torts and breach of contract and things like that as well.
I think, Stephen, gotcha. We've all had a difficult customer though, which that's the one side that I think maybe there's some aspects here to the LLC in that, you know, customer threatens legal action. Is that part of protection with an LLC?
Yes. So protection with an LLC would protect a business and business owner from reasonable decisions made that would traditionally be made throughout the course of their duty and their job. So that's a lot of words to basically just say something like, if there is a judgment call, for example, that's made by a company and they made that judgment call based on the information they had before them and it was the wrong call, the corporate veil could shield the business from liability in that case. But I always give this example about piercing the corporate veil. Let's say, you know, Stephen and I are in business together and I have an LLC and we get in a disagreement and I punch him in the face, right? He sues me for damages associated with the injuries he receives. The corporate veil will not protect me. I'm not operating within the scope of my employment. This is not a reasonable thing that people in my position and Stephen's position would do. So that's kind of the main point I wanted to make, is that it's not some cover-all absolution for anything that happens to you throughout the course of your work. You still have to maintain some semblance of reasonable business practice in order to maintain that protection of the corporate veil.
Interesting. So like if an employee were to get injured in your facility or something like that, they couldn't go after you personally if it was like a piece of equipment or something. Like they could go after the company, but not necessarily you. That's what you're more alluding to. Like
that would be a little bit
more, more interesting. So just so like shop owners know, like, so for instance, I have a real estate holding company that owns our building. That's an LLC because it's a very simple, like one lease transaction. There's not very many expenses under it. But then like, you know, and Campus Inc. is now a C Corp, which is just another story that we'll get to. But more often than not, are small businesses that do between what, like $500,000 and $3 million, are they mostly S Corps then? Or are they mostly LLCs? Or what do you see?
Or C Corp too.
Or C Corps, yeah. Like can we talk about that?
Yeah, I see them running, like for the small businesses that I represent and consult to, whether it be in this industry or others, I really see like the full range of how these business entities can be set up. I see LLCs, I see S Corps, and I see C Corps. The important thing to understand about an S Corp is the S Corp is actually a federal designation that is achieved by filling out IRS form 2553. So it's basically one form. That's why it's called a check the box election, because there's literally a one page form from the IRS. You basically check a box and you say, I want to be treated for tax purposes federally as an S Corp. So you see this a lot of interplay between state law and federal law, because S Corp isn't really a state designation. So there could be an LLC or a PC, like I'm a PC, and I choose to be taxed as an S Corp for federal purposes. So that's where it gets a little confusing. So the taxation federally is kind of this election that you're making. And just to talk a little bit about the difference between S Corps and C Corps, if we want to go there now, S Corps, the main difference is that an S Corp is about how they're taxed. And S Corps are pass-through entities, much like the LLC. And that's why an LLC can make that S Corp designation. And that's not a conflict between. So it'd be an LLC for state purposes. You would start the business and maintain it through your state's Secretary of State as an LLC. And then your tax preparer would ensure that you've made the 2553 election to be treated as an S Corp, which would then make you a pass-through entity, meaning that the income and expenses from your S Corp would trickle down again to your personal tax return. Whereas C Corps are just taxed completely separately. C Corps are treated like another, like it doesn't flow through to your individual tax return. So that's kind of
the business is taxed, and then you get an income, and then you pay tax on that income as well. Again,
pretty much right.
The C corp, from my understand, in why you guys are, and correct me if I'm wrong, if that if you're fundraising dollars, there's only a certain amount of partners or something an S corp can have. So then you have to switch to a C corp or something.
Yeah, when we started taking venture money, actually Mark required us to turn into a C corp. And so what's interesting, and maybe James, you can tell us about it, is we had to register with the state of Delaware. It's like a Delaware C corp. And I guess like all startups and like big entities have some like thing in Delaware. Can you talk about what Delaware does?
Yeah. Because it also comes up with Bernie thing. Elon moving to Texas because he didn't like Delaware, or the decisions with his pay or salary, or whatever. I don't know the details. Him moving from Delaware to Texas. But correct, like the majority of the folks are in Delaware. Not that, I mean, I think a lot of us small businesses, we just think of registering in the state that we're in. So what's the deal?
Yeah, what's up with Delaware?
So Delaware is a thing that is a
couple. Who's ever kind of been to Delaware, by the way?
Yeah.
Has anyone ever been to Delaware?
Is that a Bernie thing?
I was just going to say, I don't think Delaware really exists. I think it's like a fiction that everyone just parks their companies
at. Cayman Islands.
Yeah, exactly. So for what I know about why, and I'm sure I don't have the exhaustive list of why Delaware is a preferred destination for starting your company. But the things that I do know is that Delaware doesn't have a state income tax. So money that's made in Delaware is not taxed by the state. And there's other states like that too. They also have a low or very low cost filing fees. And they also have a very simple annual renewal form. Again, a lot of states have that. I think the big thing is the no state income tax, but I would be lying if I said I knew all the reasons why, because there are other states that have low income tax or no income tax that aren't as popular of destinations for businesses. I've never helped someone start a business in Delaware because I'm not licensed in Delaware. So that's also part of the reason. So when my clients come to me, generally, I'm setting up businesses and giving legal advice for things that are within this, within the state of Illinois, because obviously business transactions, it's not a federal body of law. It's different from state to state. There are other practice areas that we have at the office, like immigration, for example. We do a lot of immigration. That's federal. So we've got clients in like 30 states for immigration, but for specifically for business stuff, it's pretty state specific. And so, I try not to pretend to give legal advice for other states because I generally don't know, and it's not within the purview of my expertise, I guess I'd say. But, I think the main thing is no income tax, no state income tax.
The taxes side of this. So the reason why I picked S Corp for Printavo getting started is because I read that you don't pay self-employment tax, which was, you know, just another amount that I can save. And I think it was like maybe 15% or something, something significant. So are there tax benefits to consider when picking? Because I don't think we talk enough about that aspect. I mean, it seems like C Corp double taxed initially, but we'll talk about the QSBS thing, which I think is interesting on the back end. S Corp versus LLC, is there any benefits or differences there?
Again, the S Corp is just an election. So you could do both, you could be both simultaneously. You could file with your Secretary of State as an LLC and then choose to be taxed as an S Corp for federal taxation purposes. And they kind of overlay on top of each other. The S Corp, like we said, they're both pass through tax entities. Honestly, for the taxation stuff, and I try to make a practice of this with my clients or prospective clients, is we don't really get into that too much at the office, because I want my clients to deal with their CPA and their tax preparer, because even I had some things as an attorney that I was assuming, okay, I should be a C Corp or I should be an LLC. And throughout the growth of my own business, my accountant, my tax preparer advised me for certain tax reasons to switch like midstream. So like companies may start out as a simple LLC as they start making more money. Or as Steven said, for things like raising money for selling stock, you would want to be a C Corp. That's a good choice for businesses that want to raise money. Because I think there's, a limit to how many shareholders you can have in an S corp, but not in the C corp. I think it's 100. And I think that an S corp shareholders must all be located, I think, within the United States, and a C corp, they don't have to be. So some of those things kind of come into play. And not to give you a non-answer, but just because tax law is like a complicated web, and I don't have an LLM in tax law, and I'm not as educated about that as CPAs are. I always recommend, you know, I make some recommendations, and then I always tell people to speak with their tax preparer or their CPA or specifically a tax attorney, because businesses are nuanced, and how people make money and how they pay expenses could be different. And to really get into a specific answer, I would hate to give a blanket answer that maybe is not applicable to someone's specific fact pattern. So I always recommend share that information with a tax preparer and let them make a definitive, you know, decision, and to just be aware that that decision can change over the course of time, depending on how you're billing. And yeah.
Funny. So I have obviously like a couple different entities set up, and one of them is an S corp for coaching and consulting work. And so I was talking to my CPA, and he was like, "Hey, you need to do this and this." And he gave me kind of a list of homework items. And then I went on ChatGPT and I like asked it to help me, and it was like really good. I was like, "Can you help me build an accountable plan for this, this, and this?" And it like did it. And then I sent it to him. I was like, "Hey, what do you think?" He's like, "Pretty good." I was like, "Sweet, ChatGPT did it." So
that's awesome.
I don't know. Sometimes I just ask it questions like, "Can you explain?"
I do a lot too.
Can you explain an S corp to a C corp to me? Like, or I did like, "Can you run a tax estimate for me in the state of Illinois?" And it like, it was pretty good. So anyways, I'm not a lawyer or an accountant.
I will say the only thing when I ask ChatGPT is I don't know what I don't know, as in like, it's like, "Oh, that sounds right." But then like I've asked someone else and it's like, no, this is how it's actually calculated or something. But Stephen, can you talk about qualified small business stock for a C corp? Because I think that's one of the best tax benefits if you plan on at some point selling the business.
So that's called
some backup info, by the way.
QSBS. And James, you correct me if I'm where I'm saying this wrong, but if you own a C corp for 5 years, the taxes on the capital, and you sell it 5 years in a day, I believe you don't pay tax on capital gain up to like $10 million?
$10 million.
Up
to $10 million or 10 times the, like, what was invested or something like that.
All right. Now correct? Tell us what we know or don't know about this.
No, that sounds right. I'm not an expert in this either. You guys are just hearing all the things I'm not an expert in today, but
that's okay.
I'm not an expert in this either, but I do know that there is that QSBC, which, you know, how I see that play out in other areas too, is like, it's kind of the same as like, real estate, where if you sell a piece of real estate, you're susceptible to potential capital gains up to a certain limit. And those gains or capital losses can be carried over or backwards for 3 years.
1031 exchange or whatever. Is that that?
Or that's similar. So that's how capital gains works in the default. But if you do a 1031 exchange in the real estate world, which is kind of, I think, the parallel to this in the business world, you're able to identify what they call a relinquished property. And that's the property you're going to sell. And then you're able to identify what they call replacement properties. And there's all these very strict time guidelines. You must identify the replacement property, three potential replacement properties with a certain time frame. And then what you can do is basically when you sell the relinquished property, you don't pay any capital gains on that. And you can then roll that money in to the new investment so that you basically, it's called a deferral, 1031 exchange deferral program. So it's not really a forgiveness of that capital gains tax. It's a deferral and just rolling that into the next one. But you can kind of just do this an unlimited amount of times. So ideally, the thinking would be that you don't pay tax, capital gains tax on that investment as you keep rolling it into the next investment. I think this QSBC is very similar in that it allows you to take any gains. I just don't know. Do you have to reinvest those profits into something else?
So.
Or can you put them in your pocket?
No, tax-free.
So
that's but I do know not all states, not all states follow it, as in, yes, it will, you know, you can have essentially a deduction off of federal income tax, but there's like maybe five or so states that you still have to pay state tax.
Maybe another reason why Delaware is cool. Because maybe, maybe if you're incorporated in Delaware and there's no state, yeah, like you said, there's no state tax there. Yeah, I got to figure that out. I'm going to do some more research on Delaware tonight.
Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit about like partnerships with other, with having business partners. For those that know, you know, Campus Inc., I started with two business partners. Then me and one of my business partners bought the other one out. We had a buy-in, we had a buy-out. It wasn't just like rainbows and easy. It was very, very complicated and very tough. We had to have a lot of really tough conversations. I guess, what advice, James, do you have for people that go into business together? We all want everything to go right, and that's what we hope, but sometimes that's not the case. So like any best practices, horror stories, anything you might want to share about that?
Yeah, I've got both. I've got, we'll start with best practices, because hopefully that will help us to understand how to avoid the horror stories. But the best practice here is like kind of segues to what we were talking about before about the business formation. Like the business formed on a solid foundation in terms of governance is really important. So what I mean by that is, it's really important for a multi-member LLC or multi-owner corporation to have an operating agreement. A lot of companies don't, and that's just happens organically. And this is what I run into a lot in my practice is, for example, a single member starts an LLC and they bring somebody else on, and they're so focused as business owners, not even in just in this industry, but in most industries, so focused on just getting things going. And as you said, rightly, Stephen, at the beginning, everyone's goal is to just get together, combine the resources in terms of human resources, brain power, maybe financial resources, and use that to generate more capital. And that's the goal of pretty much any business. But that being said, while everything is in at its inception and the groundwork, everything seems to be fine. And oftentimes there are issues. That operating agreement that I'm referring to generally outlines for businesses how to handle things like this. So there's addition of a member, death or incapacity of a member. What happens if the business wants to wind down? What happens if the business wants to start selling shares of stock? What happens if the business wants to kick a member out? What if is that removal of the member for cause? Is it without cause? So there's so many like pieces, like so many nuances that then operating agreement can sort of anticipate based on common issues that generally happen in businesses. I've actually done custom operating agreements that even include things like inheritance with an aging member, like what's going to happen to their ownership interest in a particular business if and when they pass away. Will their children inherit it? Do the existing members want to become partners with a deceased member's wife who might not know anything about the business, or their kid who's 18? Who knows? So there's all these things that some of them are what we call like boilerplate, which I don't really change them too much in the operating agreement, like the, you know, addition of a new member and supermajority requirements and how voting power works. That's generally pretty templated and normal, but there are a lot of nuances and things that are specific to specific businesses that we can capture in that operating agreement. Of course, we can't anticipate every funky situation that's going to arise, but to be honest, most of them are embedded in there somewhere. And I think so the operating agreement and just understanding governance, maybe having titles, it all seems super commonsensical. But as you said, Stephen, when people are getting going, sometimes they miss some of these administrative things, which can have huge impact later. So just getting things set up on the right foot is so important.
So like, you know, if you own a business 50-50 with one other person and everything's split down the middle, right? And you like, how does governance work when it's 50-50 and there's no like deciding vote? Like, do judges have to get involved? Like, is it like divorce court a little bit? Like, how does that work?
Is 50-50 dumb because of that? Like, should it always be someone who actually makes the final decision?
The 50-50 ownership interest is something that can, but doesn't necessarily need to lead to 50-50 decision making power. So voting power is something that by default, it goes along with percentage ownership in a company. So if you lay out that you're 50-50 owners and the operating agreement is silent about decision making, well, then there could be a dispute there. And I like to always include some form of ADR, alternate dispute resolution embedded in the operating agreement. So like if a conflict is to occur, we would see, I've had somewhere they say, you know, if it's 50-50 and if I think X and you think Y, we're going to go to this neutral third party whose name is designated in the operating agreement. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it, as I said, is to bifurcate the voting power and not make it exactly commensurate with the ownership stake. So although, you know, that's kind of like the idea of like a silent partner. Silent partner may own 50, 60, 70, 99% of a business without any voting rights. And they're sort of just an angel investor as they, there's so many names for what people in this position do, but they may just be able to contribute money and say, I don't really have any say in what happens with this money. I'm going to leave it up to you as the professional to have the voting power and to sort of steer this ship. But I just want to be entitled to my percentage of the profits. So there's a lot of ways to do this. And to answer your question, Bruce, I don't know that it's necessarily stupid to have 50-50 ownership juices. That's how so many businesses are set up, and 1% of a business, of a big business, can be a big percentage share. So I, you know, a lot of times people don't want to cede that extra 1%. But to not have a form of decision making when it's a split decision in a 50-50 ownership situation, that could be kind of dicey. I personally wouldn't want a third party deciding for my business that I and presumably my partner know like so much more intimately than anybody else. You guys know your businesses better than anybody else knows them, right? So why would another person have the authority to come in and tell me how to make a decision? I would rather avoid that. And sometimes, I mean, this is done by, for example, having a board of directors, right? A board can potentially have voting rights. And the voting rights of the board, again, doesn't have to be every board member gets one vote. I mean, all these things are modifiable by contract, aka the operating agreement.
Yeah. So as Campusinc grows and, you know, professionalized with as a C corp, that is one thing we're actually working on, is like building that board right now. And so like Jed and I would appoint, it would be like a 7-person board. We would each appoint this many seats. The majority investor would appoint their seat. And then essentially like I report to the board, they can remove me. Right. And if you hear about CEOs or execs kind of getting booted, but still being the chairman or the founding, you know, founder of it, it's a lot of time because there's a board of directors that you actually report to. So that's, I don't know if there's a lot of print shops out here that have a board, but one thing that we did at Campusinc is we created kind of like board observers or advisors. And those are just individuals that can come kind of be a voice of reason. And I don't want to say arbitrate, but it's just our sounding board that we can all get into a room and chat through it. So there's different ways that you can do it. I'm curious, Bruce, did you do any of that at Printavo early on or?
No board. There is one now, you know? And yeah, I mean, James, our CEO, has to, you know, present to them monthly and quarterly to, on results. And I'm sure meets more often like weekly and gets feedback and so on. But yeah, it's an interesting double check. Personally, for me as an owner, I knew one print shop that does have a board that they've set up, and he's mentioned that he does like that accountability, but I personally wouldn't like it. Just as like, I don't want to, like, you know, have to go report to other people and be held to someone else like that. But yeah, I guess I could see the pros. It's like one of those things where you don't see like everyone's so excited for a long time until things go wrong. And I just wonder if there's a better best practice to think about from the start instead of 50-50. And it sounds like naming the arbitrator is a good first step to that, but maybe it is 51-49 or something like that.
Or maybe you just split up the voting power in a different way, because I mean, we're talking about two different things. I know we touched on this before, but like the money split
versus,
yeah, exactly. Sometimes, you know, one person is really driving the ship more in terms of governance and decision-making, and somebody else is more there for financial support. And there are some situations where that's pretty equal, but I wanted to ask you a question, Stephen, about like your, what you refer to as like the informal board of advisors that you were referencing. Are those, because I'm kind of fascinated by that idea, are those internal Campusinc employees, or are they like people outside of the company?
No. So when we turn into a C corp, we had a stock option pool. And so what I appointed was a few individuals that were very if we were to have a board, that were extremely reputable and trustworthy in our industry. Or like one of my professors from college in the MBA program that like has been a mentor for me. And so he's on our advisory board, if you will. They get a small amount of stock option. And then there is, you know, expectations. Hey, you're to meet with the founder and their team once a month and meet with the whole team quarterly. And so I believe we've got three of them. And it's just kind of this like, we all trust them. If we were to formalize and create a board, they would potentially be board seats. But it's kind of this way of just having like mentors, if you will, or advisors that are sort of tied in a little bit and can help us make hard decisions.
Have you found that to be beneficial so far? Like, have there been situations where you feel like you've needed to call on them, or has it just been kind of a just in case backup plan for now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we're deciding, hey, are we going to go raise another round? Right. Like they have vested interest, but they also just have interest in me. And so I could be like, hey, it's also, you can find like really notable people in a specific industry. So one of our advisors was the old executive director of the Pac-12 and is EVP of corporate partnerships for the San Francisco Giants, right? Like he can snap his fingers and get me to different places very quickly. And if we're working on like a big structure of our company, we can whiteboard it with him, right? So, you know, those are the type of people that, you know, you just want in your corner, I guess, when you're going about.
Sure. That's awesome. So, yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Like they're generally very financially invested. So they, you know, the more seats, the more maybe equity sticker. So I'm curious on the real estate side. So maybe Stephen, you can explain like how you guys set it up with your building. And then I'm curious to go back, James, and best practices for setting this up. So if people are looking, the situation is, all right, I'd like to buy this building I'm in or the next building I'm moving to. What's the best way to set it up? And I'm curious, how did you set it up, Stephen? And you talk about like the LLC owns this one and then there's pay rent. And like, what does that look like?
How do we want to go into this? So we moved into Campus Inc. moved into a new building in 2018. My business partner sold a piece of property at the time. They wanted to own the building we were in. They wanted me to own a piece of it as well. And so we actually formed three LLCs that bought this building together. And so I have a third undivided interest of this building and my other two business partners each have their own third. There's three different mortgages. And then Campus Inc. leases it from those organizations, if you will. And it's like a triple net lease. So Campus Inc. pays for, you know, all of the bills, they pay for all the taxes. And then essentially we just get a check every month to each LLC as rental income. And we did like a 5-year lease. Why that's important is because in that time frame, we actually bought one of those business partners out from Campus Inc., but he still owns the real estate with us. Does that make sense? And so that's essentially an opportunity for me to build equity, make money on the dirt that we're occupying. And then, you know, it's an investment long term that I could do whatever I want with, right? So that's kind of how it was set up and structured. I'm sure that's going to pose some questions. I'll stop there.
So with that said, like, I think there's some tax benefits too, which I know this isn't a tax episode, but I keep going back to it a little bit, but like, with depreciation and so on that you can deduct to, over what, like a 20 or 30 year period or something like that. I don't know. We're not accountants.
I think real estate is 28.5 years or something. It's all different assets have different depreciation schedules, as you're saying. But yes, you're correct. That is correct. There's also some other tax benefits as well. Just the way that the business, we'll call it the business and the holding company. In this example, the holding company is holding the real estate. So just the fact that the business gets to write off the rent that they pay to the holding company, that's an expense to the business because they need to pay rent to continue to survive. And then, so on the holding company side, they're obviously getting income in the form of those rental payments. So they have to report that income. But in the middle there, so like the holding company, for example, may have its own set of expenses, right? So the holding company, for example, is paying potentially mortgage interest. They are paying maybe a property management company. Maybe they're paying an attorney to review and renew that lease or to exercise an option. Maybe they're paying for the facility to be upkept because the holding company owns the facility, so it needs a new roof. You know, that's an expense. And so the taxation is really simple. It really just gives the business an additional expense. It gives the holding company the income to the same amount, but the holding company can then write off expenses associated with the holding company's ownership of that piece of property. So it's better than just, it's better than renting, because on the renting side, you just get the credit as an expense to the business and there's no holding company. So in that way, it's pretty beneficial. There's also, I mean, we haven't talked about
this
quite
yet. You probably write off the interest of the loan, right?
The mortgage interest. Yep.
Yeah. But even if you make money on it, so like, you know, it's another form of income. I am a landlord to Campus Inc. I make money on that every month. So what if I pay taxes on it? I have a 15-year commercial loan on it. In 15 years that thing's rent free. I'm on year, I don't know, 6 or 7. I can be a landlord to the next tenant. I can turn around and sell it. And like, I own a 14,000 square foot building. So like, there is just this point of, you know, just owning land and buildings and commercial real estate. That's just nice to have. It's a diversified way to just be a small business owner, whether or not you took pay the full tax on it. Yeah.
That's so James, like that, did that Steven do it position. Right? Did he do it right? Or what's the best practice for setting this type of situation up?
So I've represented a lot of people in this same position, everything from dentists to pediatricians, other physician groups, consulting companies, other law firms. And this is the best way to do it in terms of having the two separate companies. This is ding, how... Ding. Yeah, this is right. And you know what? Don't take it from me. I would say, Stephen, you've been in this situation now, you said, for 6 or 7 years. How do you feel? I mean, how does it feel in terms of having both things? I think the diversification of income, the additional revenue stream, the extra set of expenses. I mean, it makes sense to me, but I mean, let's ask Stephen. He's living it. So
yeah. So my business partners are older than me. Jed's 65, and he goes, "You're going to build wealth by owning land." And that was like
a McDonald's model.
He's like, and that's Jed owns farmland. He owns many warehouses. He's like, this is, you know, I don't care what happens to Campus Inc. You're going to build wealth by owning your dirt. And it was just an old man telling a young person, hey, follow me. You're going to do this. And I give my business partner Jed a lot of credit because that's how he's made his money. I do want to spend a little bit of time on buyouts, exits, getting business owners out, whether you're selling to maybe an employee, someone off the street. Like, I feel like most shop owners or business owners do not, like, this is a day that they're like, I don't know how this is going to work. And it's not something they plan for. And then they also don't know, like, how will it actually transact? Is someone just going to write me a check? Can we talk a little bit about when that day comes? What are the different structures and how that stuff works?
Yeah, I love how you asked that question, because the way you asked it is really indicative of the answer, to be honest. And the reality is that we've done these so many different ways, and that this could be structured a lot of different ways. So the first thing that comes to my mind anytime we're talking about buying or selling any business or acquiring or merging or anything like that is value, right? Like, that's the elephant in the room, is what is this thing worth? And my best friend from kindergarten actually is somebody that I stay very closely connected to because our industries overlap quite a bit, but he owns a commercial appraisal company. Essentially, what they do is they appraise commercial real estate. It's pretty specific to real estate. He also, their company has their license to also value businesses, but that is kind of a totally different beast than just valuing real estate. So sometimes it's these two components together, like in Steven's situation, if someone is selling just a business, that's one math problem. If someone is selling the business with the real estate, it's a different math problem. But for these buy-sell agreements, they could take so many different forms and shapes, and how people can get paid could also be a lump sum. It could be gradual over the course of a 5-year period. It could be including some compensation for the seller of the business to stay on as either CEO or a consultant, so that the new owner can ensure that they're, you know, steering the ship in the same way that it was steered, which presumably got that business to its successful point in being ready for sale. So, for buy and sell agreements, it also depends on how many owners there are in an existing company. If it's, you know, mom and pop, where mom and pop own the business, it's generally easier than if it's, you know, there's a bunch of shareholders. So I don't know how to get too granular with it, because every situation, I know this sounds like a cop-out answer, every situation is so different that you kind of just need to like assess the value of the property, the value of the business, who the sellers are, who the buyers are, what the goals are for the buyers, how quickly to get paid. And so everything is, you know, as they say in the law, everything is negotiable by contract. So if you can write it on a piece of paper, as long as it doesn't violate the law or public policy, the parties can do it. So I don't know if you have any more specific questions that I might be able to
shed light on. In our industry, the owners are usually pretty invested in the business as operators, meaning like if you were to take them out of the picture, sometimes the business would collapse, or like there's a lot of value that rides on the owner, which devalues the company quite a bit, unfortunately. And so if you're trying to sell your shop and you as the owner are spending a ton of time in there and the business is dependent on you, you will have to assume that you will have to be tied to it for a minute, right? Like rarely will someone just write you a check and say, see ya, you're leaving. I feel like that just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, how do you set up your business? What are the perfect situations, maybe the three perfect check boxes that you need to check if you want to sell your business for the highest value and have to do the least amount of work after selling it?
So my first recommendation is going to seem a little bit counterintuitive, but, and I've got the first two in my head. I'm going to try to think of what the third one is as I go, maybe as I talk about, but the first situation is to maybe remove, as the owner operator, maybe start gearing up to remove yourself prior to sale. And what I mean by that is create somebody or something or a team of people or infrastructure or a system that would enable somebody to presumably step in and continue operations. And obviously, I think everyone understands stepping in and continuing operations is never going to be exactly how the original owner occupier did it, especially on day one. There's going to be a learning curve. There's going to be money lost. Maybe it's not going to be a perfect conversion of every dollar captured that the previous owner did, because a new operator may have to learn a little bit about that industry. But by setting up a proxy owner operator, a proxy operator, and that would honestly give a business owner a feel for how the business would look and run in their absence. I'm representing a business right now that's actually going through exactly this. And what the CEO is doing over the course of the last 2 years, kind of just gearing it up for sale. And you heard that right. It is 2 years for him. And he's probably not ready for another 2 years. He's very type A, very on top of it. He's got business development coaches and consultants, and he's doing this the right way. And I consult with him as well. And his thinking is, as the CEO, he's basically trying to remove himself and create all of these C-suite positions that are going to be able to do what he does in his absence. So now his trial runs are like, all right, I'm going to go to Mexico for a month and try not to answer my email. And it's like 6 weeks. And so I've watched him sort of do this and make this thing really, his business really, really marketable asset. And, you know, you may be thinking this is like a 50 person company. It's not. He's got like 8 employees and he's got 2 or 3 admins. So this is not a huge company. And he's been able to sort of temporarily replace himself or recreate himself. And it hasn't been one person. It's been a team of people that have kind of been set up to do what he does. So that's maybe one thing, is to present your business as a marketable asset that doesn't require the owner operator to be present in order for it to continue to be profitable. So, and I know that's a little general, but that's a really strong recommendation. So that my second recommendation had to do with, let me remember it now. The first was replace. Second would be We talked about valuation.
And I think there's two, and that sounds like that on the strategic. Yeah. Why you get that one? There's two strategic things that I've seen that have been helpful with that in terms of maximizing value and or creating a deal that benefits you and your lifestyle after. I think number one is, exactly what you're saying, which is literally operating it as if you don't want to, right? Like people tend to want other things that they can't have. And so, you know, if you're in a good place, that you don't need to sell, it's when you're on your back foot that you need to buy. It's when you're going into the car dealership and your other one's broke down, you have to buy a car that they exactly know that, that you don't have much negotiating power here. And then the other aspect with that is, lining up multiple buyers. So if you can have people that are very serious on multiple ends, you start to have more chips in your pocket that you can be able to negotiate against both sides. But again, I think that's a little bit more of the strategy side.
I think it's also important, you know, like small business owners hate paying taxes, like, right? Schedule 179, depreciate everything, bring that number down to zero.
See that in the Facebook group. I've got $100,000 left. How do I spend it?
Yeah.
Which I'm like, dude, what the hell?
And so in your last, because your business, this is that word EBITDA, right? Is going to be a multiple of profit. And the more true profit you can share, even if you have to pay taxes on it, God forbid, your business is going to be way more valuable. And so if you are constantly making your business purposefully make $0 every year, like you're sort of shoving future, like the value of it down the drain a little bit. Now they can back that all out and figure out ways, but you do want to show a ton of profit. I'm curious, James, what about if a shop wants to buy another business, right? Like, is that just a clean exchange of hands? Is there earnout? Is that handled the same way? Because I've heard of different businesses and shops saying like, we're going to merge together. Can you talk a little bit about like merging and how that works?
Yeah, sure. If I can just go back really quick, I did remember my point number two. And it kind of segues into this. So point number one was like the human resources element, like for the owner operator to sort of remove themselves. Point number two was to have a setup of systems and report, like reporting and enough data to where a potential buyer can, you could send them something like an offering, right? So, and that kind of has to do with what you just said about taxes, I think is super important. I'm always left with this example of people who, for example, in the real estate world, which is a lot of what I do, in the real estate world, they want their appraisal to be as low as possible when they're getting their home or business or commercial real estate appraised for tax purposes, right? They're going to do a tax appeal and they get my buddy's company to appraise the property and they want that number to be low. Now, all of a sudden they're refinancing 3 months later and they want that number to be as high as possible because they need to borrow against the assessed, against the appraised value. So it's sort of the same idea that you're talking about here is like for tax purposes as business owners, we want that number to be as low as possible. But to make our product or our offering as marketable as possible, we want it to be higher. So you do see this kind of conflict, you know, these conflicting interests come into play. My best advice there is obviously, if you anticipate that you are gearing your business up to become a marketable asset or to be sold or merged with in the near future, it's not a good idea to, you know, bring down your total gross income as low as possible on your tax return, because that's generally the operative document that a potential buyer is going to look at. Again, to your point, Stephen, a sophisticated buyer will be able to parse that out and understand this was done for tax sheltering, tax avoidance, and kind of just look at maybe gross income as a top line number. But we don't want to, I mean, when you're, you don't want to have to explain that. It makes it a little less appealing. And then to the question you just asked about mergers, it's essentially the same in a lot of respects in that it's really just a matter of figuring out equity positions and compensation. I think a merger is generally easier than a buyout, and generally there's more excitement from both parties. And a lot of times that just kind of greases the wheels of the deal. Sometimes if it's more akin to an acquisition than a merger, then one of the parties may not be super excited about that. They may feel that they're getting shortchanged. Again, but same basic principles. Appraisal, we find out what, you know, we need an appraisal, get a value. What you said about EBITDA, there's this book that I've taken a look at a couple times in these situations, and it actually has these really cool like quick and dirty equations for how to value a business. And it's super industry specific. So you can get this book and you can flip to the page on law firms and it will tell you like some rules of thumb, they call them, like, okay, 3x EBITDA plus, you know, goodwill associated with, you know, if you've got 600 potential past client or, you know, past clients in your address book, that you can have names, email addresses, what the matter type was and whether or not they were happy with your service. You know, if you could put all that together, then that's another multiplier. So there's, these aren't like official valuation strategies. And they're really, you know, I know a little bit about valuation. There's really three ways to value real estate. And this is not one of them. But when you line this, when you run things through this equation and then do it the way a CPA would do it, which is, you know, an EBITDA-based calculation, they end up being very similar. And I personally think that this book has rules of thumb that actually capture things that are not captured in the traditional valuation methods. But I guess that's either here nor there. But the important thing is that value and understanding negotiating power. Again, if it's an acquisition and you're the bigger company and there's a failing company that you're acquiring, you're in a little bit different of a leverage position than maybe two companies that are equally succeeding and just want to join forces because they have some synergies that could, you know, help both of the companies. So posture and leverage matters a lot.
James, what's that book called? Do you know?
I'm going to get it for you. It's I'll get you a title for it. Shortly. Sweet. I'm going to text my buddy who let me look at it. Yeah.
We're running a little bit out of time here. You can only practice law in the state of Illinois. So if you are a business owner and a shop owner and you're in Illinois, I can reach out to you. Right? Is that how it works? I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Sure. I'm okay. Always happy to consult with people. And I love meeting new business owners, especially young entrepreneurial people who just, you know, the sky is the limit type thing. So I get super excited by business ownership and all these different things about buying, selling, and especially the real estate piece. I think that's people who can take advantage of that and incorporate that into their business. I think it's a huge plus. But yeah, happy to talk to anybody in Illinois about any questions or consultations or business related needs they might have.
That's BEBAWYlaw.com. And we'll drop that URL and James, your info in the description so you guys can check that out and be able to reach out with other questions. But yeah, James, we appreciate you joining us. This is super enlightening. Print Hustlers, we appreciate you, as always, joining us for another weekly episode of the Print Hustlers podcast. We'll see you again next week. Have a good one. Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.